This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hal Needham, is probably the most famous living Hollywood stuntman. He did the kind of stunts that would either end with a spectacular shot or an ambulance. As we'll hear, one stunt with a four-door Chevy left him with a broken back, six broken ribs, a punctured lung, and three missing teeth. He got his start in Western movies and TV shows like Laramie, Laredo, and Have Gun Will Travel, on which he was Richard Boone's stunt double and the show's stunt coordinator. After many years of jumping on horses and stagecoaches and falling from great heights after being shot, he became famous for car stunts, especially his work in Burt Reynolds' movies. He was the stunt coordinator in Gator and White Lightning and directed Cannonball Run, Smokey and the Bandit, and Hooper. He's done stunts in 4,500 episodes of TV and 310 feature films. Hal Needham has written a new memoir called Stuntman, My Car-Crashing, Plane-Jumping, Bone-Breaking, Death-Defying Hollywood Life. Hal Needham, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, what were some of the standard Western stunts of the 50s and 60s when you were making the Westerns?
Well, it had mostly to do with what we call a saddle fall, where you get shot and fall off the horse. We did horse falls, rearing falls. Wagon wrecks, buggies, and so on and so forth. A thing called a bulldog, where the bad guy's trying to get away, the good guy comes up behind him, jumps from his horse, and then knocks the guy off the horse, and it normally winds up in a big fight. And we did high falls and some roping stuff, and pretty well covered the major of them anyway.
Yeah. Now, one of your early stunts was for Have Gun Will Travel, and you were jumping from a rock about 30 foot high onto a stagecoach that was moving by.
Oh, yeah.
And you're supposed to land on the top of the stagecoach as it rides by. Tell us what happened.
Well, first of all, that was my second stunt on Have Gun Will Travel. I had double boomed the day before, and he was kind of impressed, and he said, all right, you can do some stuff tomorrow. I got out there, and they said, can you jump from that rock to the top of a coach as it's going by, as it's passing? I said, I think so. So anyway, the rock was 30 feet high, and the top of a coach is 6 feet long and 4 feet wide. They said, you want to see a rehearsal? I said, why not? They brought that thing under me, and I thought, I might have let my alligator mouth overload my Jaybird back in again, but because it really looked small, looked like a postage stamp. Anyway, they brought the coach through, and I hit it right in the center. As a matter of fact, I broke through the top right up to my armpits, and that kind of shocked the folks inside the coach. And when they got us stopped, Boone came over and offered me the job of being the stunt coordinator as well as his double on Have Gun Will Travel.
So let me ask you, when you're jumping off a 30-foot high rock onto a moving stagecoach, the top of which looks like a postage stamp because it's so relatively small from the height that you're at. Mm-hmm. What kind of mental calculation do you do to figure out when to jump?
You know what? You can't say, all right, when the coach gets there to that mark, I'm going to jump. You just have to look at it because you don't know how fast those horses are going to be running, anything else. It's just a thing that it's a clock inside of you that you say now and you go. There's no way to set a mark or anything like that to leave the rock.
Now, on that stunt, was there protection for you? Like, if you missed the coach, was there padding on the ground?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. It'd be impossible. First of all, they'd have to pad the road in front and behind, and the horses can't go through that. And over the side, they'd have to camouflage it. No, it's just too much of a problem. And if you say you can do it, they expect you to do it.
I say this with the greatest of respect. I think you have to be crazy to be a stuntman like you.
I won't argue that point.
Okay. So one of the standard shots that you'd have to do is, like, you're the bad guy and you're being shot and you have to fall. So
You mean fall off the horse or fall off of what?
Fall off a balcony, fall off a horse,
a
rock.
Yeah.
You've fallen off all of them. So, say, like, you're falling, you're shot, you're falling off from a height.
Yeah.
So when you started making Westerns, what protection was there for you to fall onto?
Well, when I started, and that's a long time ago, they would take sawhorses, you know, like carpenters use.
Mm-hmm.
They take those and they put 1x12, pine 1x12s across the top, put some cardboard boxes underneath it, and put a mattress or two on top of it, and that's what saves you from being killed, because the boards would bend about 6 inches, and then they'd all break, and then the boxes would catch you. So that's what they had, and believe me, 45, 50 feet in off of that, into those, about all you could handle.
It sounds so makeshift.
Oh, it definitely was, but, you know, that's all they could come up with at the time, and I'm going to be really braggadocious here. I'm the one that brought airbags into the stunt world.
What's the highest jump you've done?
100 feet.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Hal Needham, who is one of the greatest stuntmen in movie history. And he has a memoir now called Stuntman, My Car Crashing, Plane Jumping, Bone Breaking, Death-Defying Hollywood Life. He's also a director, and he directed Hooper and Smokey and the Bandit, Cannonball Run. Now, let's get back to Westerns for a minute. You say one of the most dangerous stunts in Westerns, and if you've seen a Western, you've seen this one. It's the stirrup drag, where a guy falls off his horse, but his leg is still in the stirrup, and the horse keeps galloping, dragging the cowboy across the ground over rocks and brush and who knows what else. Why is that the most dangerous Western stunt?
Well, there's a couple of things. Matter of fact, I saw one of our stuntmen get killed doing a stirrup drag.
Wow.
He had to go through the gate of entrance to a ranch, and when he fell off the horse, you rehearse them so they'll go where you want them to go. Well, this horse didn't follow where he's supposed to go, and when he came to the gate, he swung around, the horse did, and it flung the guy way out to the side, and he hit his head on the post, the fence post, and killed him. So that's the reason it's so dangerous, one reason. The other is, when you fall off the horse and hit the ground, you're tied to the horse with a cable, to the stirrup. And when you hit the end of that cable, it flings you back under the horse's feet, his back feet. And so you got to put one foot up against the horse's belly to keep yourself from being stepped on by his back feet. It's pretty dangerous. Now, the way we get release, you have a release on your foot to the cable, and you just put a little wire up to your belt, and you pull that, and that's supposed to release you. If that doesn't work, you have a second release on, hooked with a cable, something back way back by camera, and that releases the whole saddle. And if that doesn't work, you put two or three what you hope are your buddies on the fastest horses you can find, and they're called pickup men. They get out there, and if they see you're in trouble, they're supposed to come in, stop the horse and get you loose. It's really, really dangerous.
Were you ever hurt during one of those yourself?
Thank God, no, I never was. I've done quite a few of them, and I just got lucky.
So what goes through your mind when a stuntman is killed? Is that it must be a very sobering experience.
We're all aware of the fact that it can happen. And hopefully, when you get ready to do the stunt, you've got it figured out, you got your confidence up, you say this is going to be okay, and you go for it. And when something goes wrong, we all understand it, because we've all had things go wrong. One stunt I did, I broke my back, sixth rib, punctured a lung, knocked out some teeth. That wasn't the way I had it planned at all.
Yeah, I'm sure it wasn't. We'll talk about that one a little bit later.
Okay.
One of your most dangerous stunts was for a Western, Little Big Man, about Custer's Last Stand. And
right.
So describe the stunt that you had to do here.
Dustin Hoffman and his wife are heading west, and they're in a stagecoach, got a six up a horse's hook to it. They get attacked by the Indians. The shotgun guard gets shot off the coach. The driver turns chicken, and he's up there huddling in the boot of the coach hiding. So the horses run away. A stuntman, Dublin Dusty, got out of the coach, climbed up on the seat, and jumped to the closest horse to the coach. I, as an Indian, came up on the outside and transferred from my horse to the one right next to him. Then he stands up and jumps from that horse to the back of the one ahead of him and I follow him. Then he does it again out to the leader, and I followed him out there. So we did that three times, but we did the whole scene 13 times. And here's what's really hard to believe. We had to do a standing broad jump from the back of one horse to the back of the next one of 14 feet. And I tell you what, there's no athlete I don't think can do that standing still.
These are horses that are in motion.
Oh,
they're galloping.
Run away.
Yeah.
Run away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Coach, run away. When we were training the horses to accept us jumping on their back and everything, the way we found we could jump the furthest was to get in motion, get in sync with a horse. So when he pushed off his back feet, we would use his momentum to get us that extra 2 or 3 feet so we would get to the next horse. It was the toughest physical stunt I ever did in my life.
Now, I hate to bring this up, but had you failed, you would have been trampled by the horses.
Oh, well.
Or run over by the coach, depending on where you were. Yeah.
You'd had 2, 4, or 6 horses run over you, plus a 4,000-pound coach, yeah. You couldn't fail. If you messed up, you was going to be in big trouble.
So you worked with a lot of horses doing Westerns. You owned horses. You trained horses. Two of your most beloved horses were named Hondo mm-hmm. and Alamo.
Uh-huh.
And Hondo lost his life as a result of a stunt. He broke his leg doing a stunt.
Yep. That's right.
What happened?
Well, you know, matter of fact, it was on Little Big Man. I played the Indian that came down and jumped from my horse to the horse pulling the coach. The director wanted a shot of me coming off the hillside prior to that shot, prior to me transferring. So he said, come fast as you can. I said, all right. And it was fall, and the hillside, the grass was all dead and everything. So here I come off the hill just as fast as Hondo could run. And in a blink of an eye, I was sailing through the air, and he had stepped in a gopher hole and broke his leg. And so he slid a long way, so do I. And I looked back, and I could see he was trying to get up. So I went back and to take a survey and see what was wrong and so on, and I realized he had broken his leg. So I held him down. Here's the part that I think shows how much I love the horse. We were way out in the country, and I said, "Is anybody got a gun?" So when a horse breaks a leg, unless he's a thoroughbred or something, you destroy him, you put him out. So I said, "Anybody got a gun?" The prop man said, "No, I don't have one." And my buddy said, "Well, he had one in the car." So I said, "Go get it," and he came back and handed me that gun. You know, I could not shoot that horse, and the reason I had to shoot him, or somebody had to shoot him, was they said, if you don't get a vet out here and verify that he had a broken leg before you kill him, you can't collect the insurance. I said, well, hell, it's going to take 1.5 hours, 2 hours to get a vet out here. I don't want that horse to lay there suffering. Get me a gun, you know? So anyway, we wound up shooting him. And don't tell me a big man don't cry, because I did.
Did it change how attached you allowed yourself to become to your stunt horses?
No, you know what? I made so much money with them, and I was such buddies with them. I'll tell you 2 stories if you'll let me. One was, I had one of them, and I was just practicing a little bit, and I fell and came up, and I was in my backyard, or right close to my backyard. My wife is out there, and I fell this horse, and I was sitting there. I sat up on my butt, and I was just sitting there on the ground, and he came up, and he put his head over my shoulder, and I scratched his chin under his chin. My wife said, if you did that to me, we'd get along a hell of a lot better, you know. So that's how. But also, I have a thing in my book about when a horse, if I got 2 together, I kept those 2 together all the time, so they become buddies. When you take one away, the other one would just pace back and forth in the corral until they worked up a sweat. Or sometimes, if they're ill, a little ill, they got a stomach ache or something, they'll do the same thing. I've been known to go out in the corral with them out in the barn, take some hay and make myself a bed and get a tarp and just cover up and sleep with them, out there in the barn with them. When I do, they calm down immediately, you know, and they'll come over and sniff me and eventually they'll start eating the hay I'm laying on and things like that. You got to have that rapport with them to understand them.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Hal Needham, and he is probably the most famous stuntman in Hollywood.
Can I say something?
Yes.
Highest paid.
And highest paid.
I was the highest paid stuntman in the world.
I know that means a lot to you. And while we're on the subject, every time you have to redo a stunt because they didn't get the take they wanted or the camera wasn't in the right place, you get paid again, right?
Ching, ching. Just ring it up.
Okay.
And you know what? Sometimes cameramen, if you had a good friend that was an operator, a camera operator, he'd say, damn, I missed that. And he'd come over, and then he'd come over and say, how's that, Hal? And I'd say, that's fine with me, you know.
That's great. You wouldn't have felt that way about the most difficult stunts, though, right?
No. I was happy to see those gone.
So you did so many Westerns. You did so many horse stunts. But later in your career, you became really famous for your car stunts. So let's talk about one of your stunts. This is one from White Lightning. We had to jump a car from land onto
a
floating barge. How far away was the barge from where you were?
That barge was supposed to be because it was up against a bank, and then he was to be backing out into the water. And it's a long story, so I'll just cut it real short and say I had him do it a couple of times in practice, and I thought, okay, I want him about 75 feet out. So when I hit my ramp, I'd be doing about 70 miles an hour and knew I could hit this big barge and everything would be good. But what I didn't know is when we got ready to shoot it, I said, Captain, you ready? He said, yeah. I said, okay, when I say go, firewall that thing. That means the throttle. Put it all the way of the firewall. Well, he did, and he was about 85 feet out. And so when I went out, when I was in the air, I said, this ain't going to be pretty. I hit the back of the barge with the front of my car, and it just stood it up in the air, and it balanced right on the back end. The back wheels were in the water. I was out of that thing in a heartbeat. But the reason he was so far out, he had been rehearsing at three-quarter throttle, and I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
So when I told him to firewall it, he said, okay. You know, so you got to be real careful. If that were another stuntman driving that barge, he'd know what I meant. But this guy, he was a local down there in Arkansas, and he had no idea, and he wanted to do exactly as I wanted him to. So when I said firewall it, he took me at my word, and he firewalled it, and damn near killed me. I mean, had that thing fallen into the river, first of all, the river was muddy, deep, and swift. I had a couple of stunt guys out there with scuba gear on. I'd have been down Louisiana before they found me.
When you did hit with the front of the car onto the bar, how great was the impact? I mean, you were flying through the air. Must have really hit hard.
I had a hand on each side of the steering wheel. I bent that steering wheel right down against, on both sides, right down against the steering column, you know, where the steering wheel comes out. I bent it completely down. I put a big knot on my forehead, and even with harness on, I had safety harness, shoulder harness on, I still went forward far enough to hit the steering wheel. And it really didn't hurt me. When I got out of the car, I looked out the window and I saw water below me, and I said, I'm thinking, this thing goes in the water, I'm dead. Man, they timed it on film, you know, 24 frames a second, so they could time it. I was out of that car in about 2.5 seconds, standing on the barge. When I got on the barge, I just passed out, you know. But I had enough consciousness to know I had to get out of there. When I got on the barge where I was safe, I said, oh, hell, I just fell down and laid down. But didn't hurt me. Didn't hurt me.
So how do you end up doing something like that again? I mean, you use that take. I don't mean literally doing
that
stunt again.
That.
But going out and doing more stunts after flying through the air and nearly killing yourself. Why do you go and do it again?
Well, because it's better than robbing 7-Elevens, you know. I mean, what else am I going to do? And besides, I said, okay, when I found out what happened with the captain, I said, okay, So next time I got to watch for that. I got to, you know, rethink the situation, make sure I don't make that mistake again. But my confidence didn't wane from that, because I know had he not been way out there, that car landed 20, 30 feet onto the barge, and I'd been perfect, you know? So you just got to look it all over and clear up your mistakes and say, let's go.
Let's talk about the stunt that really came close to killing you. You broke six ribs, you broke your back, you punctured a lung, and you lost, I think it was, three teeth. Yep. This is for the John Wayne film McHugh. Why don't you describe the stunt, like what was supposed to happen?
We were up in Washington, and the script called for John Wayne to be going down the beach, and the bad guys come up and shoot his car up and things or whatever. So instead, when they pull up alongside, the bad guys pull up alongside of him, Wayne sticks an automatic out the window and blows them apart, and the car is supposed to turn over on the beach. Well, you can't turn a car over just on flat surface. It would be really hard to do, and maybe you get it, maybe you won't. So the stunt coordinator was a kid named Ronnie Rondell, and he said, Hal, you got any ideas? And I said, yeah. So I told him my idea, and he said, well, we can't do that first time in front of the camera. In case it don't work, we look like a bunch of fools. I said, I'll go home and practice. So I called one of my buddies at home. I said, get an old junker car. I want you to get a cannon with walls an inch and a half thick and about 3.5 feet long. Weld it in the back of the car, behind the front seat, in the back of the car, back seat, with a muzzle pointed towards the ground. And I said, get me a foam pole, 3.5 feet long, so we can shove that foam pole up in there, put a wire under the bottom of it to hold it. But mainly the thing I really said get was 5 4-ounce black powder bombs. And I put those bombs up in the cannon with a button so I could fire them, put the pole in, and they pushed me. The car wouldn't even run. They pushed me with the pickup truck, and I told them when they got to 55 miles an hour, blow the horn back off. I threw the car sideways and hit the button. Next thing I knew, I was upside down, backwards, going backwards across a desert floor about 30 feet in the air, and I said, boy, there's going to be some kind of wreck here any moment. And there was. When I hit, I mean, the car hit on the top, it caved in, and they couldn't hardly get me out, and when I got out, I wasn't breathing. But anyway, that's how it happened. It was the damnedest wreck you ever seen in your life.
Okay, so just to recap, you broke your back, six ribs, punctured a lung, and lost three teeth. And you had already broken your back once before.
Yes.
You've broken many more bones than the bones just mentioned. How many?
Oh, I broke 56 total.
Okay.
In doing stunts. Yeah. I broke seven last summer.
So seven last summer?
Yeah, well, I was helping my neighbor unload some brush, and I fell off the truck.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That wasn't even a stunt. That was real life.
No. Yeah.
So are you in pain now?
No. No. I tell you what, and I don't limp, and I'm not all hunched over or anything else. I'm in pretty damn good shape, considering everything I've done to my body. I have no pain. I go to bed, and I go to sleep, and I work out in the gym every day, and, you know, I'm okay.
Now, what kind of painkillers were you used in the 50s and 60s when you were at the peak of your stuntman career?
Percodan. Carried a bottle with me all the time. When a stuntman got hurt, they call Hal and tell him to bring his Percodan. When I'd go on location, like maybe go down to Mexico or somewhere like that, we're doing 3 or 4 months down there, hell, I'd take 100 with me. And because I know I'd be the only one that had them, so I could pass them out when the guys got hurt. And you work a lot when you're hurt if you're a good stuntman, because you're going to be hurt quite a bit. And you can't let a sore leg or a bruise or something like that stop you, so you just take a Percodan and go to work.
But that dulls your senses, doesn't it?
No. You know what? Now, I say no. I'm not a doctor. But I tell you what, it didn't bother my timing and everything, not one iota. I could do the same things after taking Percocet then than I did before I took them. It didn't bother me.
I must interrupt here and say, do not try this at home.
No.
Did you ever have an addiction problem to painkillers?
No, you see, I knew, my doctor told me, he said, Hal, these things are addictive. He said, don't get hooked on these. And I said, okay. And my hand to God, and I never took a Percodan unless I was really hurting. And the minute I got over the hurt, I quit taking Percodan. I mean, I had enough sense, I think, to realize that I didn't want to be an addict. So I just made damn sure I never took them. Even though I had them all the time, I'd never took them unless I absolutely had to. And I mean, had to. I've done stunts when I was hurting so bad I couldn't hardly breathe. And yet, go ahead and do it. And if it were something that I couldn't perform unless I had use of this leg or an arm or something like that that was really sore and hurting, then I'd take one.
Now, I know you wear hearing aids. You have one in each, yes, in each ear. Did you lose some hearing from explosions?
Yes, I was in Czechoslovakia doing a film called Bridge at Remagen. And believe me, when you work in a country where the languages are different, you got to be really, really careful. The shot was, they had a Czechoslovakian soldier in the tank, and just a small window that he was looking out of. The director had a camera up behind the tank, up in the air, looking down over the top of the tank and the barrel of the gun. I was a soldier running across in front of the barrel, and he wanted to fire it. And I said, okay, but you got to wait till I get to a certain point. And he said, well, that's okay. So I put the soldier inside, and I said, along with my interpreter, and I said, tell him to watch me. We're going to do this 4 or 5 times. When he sees me throw my hand in the air, when we do the shot, that's when I want him to fire the cannon. That means I'm going to be about 10 feet past it. I said, okay. Well, hell, you know the answer. I run by there. When he saw me, he fired a thing, and it was right over the top of my head, blew my helmet off, knocked me down. People came running over, and I could see their lips moving, but I couldn't hear a damn thing. Well, that's the medicine over there, the doctor's cares and thing, that's not too good. Anyway, I went to the doctor there, and he said, yeah, he's got a problem, but we think it's going to be all right. Fair enough, and then back to the set I go. After a couple of days, I started hearing, I could hear people if they were close and spoke real loud. When I got home, I went to a hearing specialist, and he said, yeah, you did some damage to your eardrums. You got to wear hearing aids. And that was 69, 70, something like that.
Now, among the things to your credit are some inventions that mm-hmm. have helped you and other mm-hmm. stuntmen do your job, you know, effectively. For example, you came up with a way of people being blown into the air on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell us about the old way versus your way.
Okay. The old way, special effects would dig a little hole in the ground, put a charge in it. Stuntman run by, set the charge off the stuntman, and fling his body as far as he could, get all out of shape and everything. You can only fling your body so far. So I came up with an apparatus. It's only about 3.5 inches high and about 14 inches square. It's got a plate on top that's air activated. So when you step on that plate, it triggers this activation of the air of the ram, and that top piece will throw you through the air. And the more pressure you put on it, the higher it'll throw you. That thing will put you 30 feet in the air if you want to go that high, and if you can go that high. So what you do is you hook the explosion onto that air ram so it, when it activates the plate that throws you, it also sets off the charge. And believe me, it looks effective, and you look like you really got blown up.
And what about landing on the way down?
That's your problem. No. It's like working off of a trampoline or something. You learn to control your body, and the best way to do it is when you see the ground come up is do what you call a tuck and roll. I always live in my right hand. I use it as a gauge. When it touched the ground, I just tucked it under real tight, go right to my shoulder. Hell, I could just roll out and come right up on my feet.
Huh. Now, you introduced rocket power to stunts.
Yes, I did.
How?
I had a friend, Bill Frederick, who was an engineer, and he was building a rocket car to break the sound barrier. And but he told me he knew about all of the things we did in business and everything. And he said, "Hal, boy, you'd be surprised what you can do with rocket power." So anyway, he took me out. We got an old car. He built me a small rocket. It had, I don't know, I think maybe 5,000 pounds of thrust or something. I don't remember. But it was only about as big as a Coke bottle. And put it on the car, and you point the nozzle to the ground. You can just drive along, hit that button. It'll just flip that car right over. And now, when I did Hooper, I directed Hooper, we made a jump. Bert jumps a river there where a bridge is out and all this stuff. We put a rocket, a big rocket, in the back of a car and jumped it probably about 450 feet through the air to the other side. Of course, we didn't have anybody in the car, but anyway, it. So I introduced rocket power, and they use it quite a lot now.
So, as a stuntman, you've doubled a lot of people, including Burt Reynolds, mm-hmm. who became a very good friend. You met him on the TV series Riverboat.
That's right.
Went on to be his stunt double and good friend. You lived in the carriage house of his house for many years.
I lived there 12 years, yes, yeah. In his guest house.
So in order to double somebody, whether it's Burt Reynolds or Richard Boone, the star of Paladin, who you doubled for a long time, how close do you have to be to their size and to their figure?
Well, the closer you are, the closer the camera can work to you. So, for instance, James Arnaz on Gunsmoke was like 6'4", probably 230 pounds, and as a joke, Andy McLaughlin, the director who loved to put me on the spot and things, said, "Hal, tomorrow I want you to double Jim Arnaz." And I said, "Get out, Andy." He said, "No." So all I had to do was do a transfer from my horse to a horse pulling the buckboard. And me and Jim Arnaz, wore a hat that had a 7-8-inch brim on it. When I put that thing on, I looked like a flying saucer with legs, you know what I mean? But they put the camera way back, so it could have been a trained chimpanzee out there, and they wouldn't have known the difference.
So before you became a stuntman, did you see many movies with a lot of stunts in them? Like, your parents were sharecroppers?
Yeah, yes.
You grew up, you know, in a rural area. Probably weren't
rural. Rural, that ain't even the right word. I was so far back in the mountains, they had to pump sunshine to us.
So there probably weren't a lot of movie theaters around.
I never saw a movie till I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, we had no electricity, no plumbing, indoor plumbing, nothing. I mean, you couldn't get a Model A Ford couldn't drive any closer than about 3 miles to our house because of big ruts and rocks and things. We were poor. I mean, poor.
So how did you break into Hollywood?
Quite by accident. First of all, before I went in the military, I was a tree topper. When I went in the military, I was a paratrooper.
Meaning you could climb to the top of trees and prune them or do whatever.
Yeah, right. Tree topper. Tree topper. And then I joined the military. I volunteered for the paratroops. I got out. I moved to Orange County. I met a guy there who was an ex-paratrooper who was trying to break into Hollywood. And the first thing I did was with him. He got us a job. It was on a show called You Ask For It. It was a request program. And he wrote the request, and we did the stunt. And what it was, he was on horseback at a full gallop, obviously, and I was sitting out on the wheel of a 150 Cessna, and as we flew over, I jumped out of the Cessna and knocked him off the horse. That's where I got my first job. He got me my second job, which was The Spirit of St. Louis, story of Lindbergh's life. starred Jimmy Stewart. His and my job were to either stand on the top of the wing, old biplane, double wing planes, as they were doing loops and turns and things, or hanging, be on a rope ladder hanging, that was me, upside down, hanging by my ankles on a rope ladder, and then transfer from the top of one wing to the bottom of another one. And that was my second job, and I said, wow, look at all the money I made. I think I'll change jobs, so I decided to be a stuntman, and that's where I went.
Do you mind my asking how old you are now?
80. I'll be 80 March 6th.
So now that you can't do extreme stunts...
I can't do anything.
What do you do to get the adrenaline going?
Well, maybe I'm adrenalined out, I don't know. To keep in shape, I work out. I go to the gym. I have a gym in my building where I live. I like to play golf. And so that pretty well occupies my time.
And do you see a lot of movies now?
Quite a few. I'm an Academy member, and I belong to Screen Actors Guild, the Directors Guild, and the Writers Guild. And they all have theaters, and I get invitations. I can go to anything, any of them anytime I want to. So, yeah, I get to see quite a few.
So when you see special effects now that are using computer-generated graphics...
I hate it.
Yeah,
hate it.
Okay. I thought you might think
that. I hate it. You know, I've seen film, and one particular comes to mind. A guy jumps off of a 250-foot dam and hits the water, and they cut to the water, and he bobs up like he's a duck or something, you know? And you go, wait a minute. Give me a break. A guy'd kill himself doing that. There's no way you could do it. And it's just with cars and motorcycles and all kinds of things. And to me, it takes all the reality out of the show. I just can't stand it. Because I grew up, and even as a director, we never used that stuff. We did it for real. And I can look at it on screen and say, that's BS. That don't work. You can't do that. And so... I lose all interest in the film, and I've walked out of, and you're not supposed to do that at the Academy. You're supposed to sit there through it whether you like it or not, but after so much of that stuff, I just say to hell with it, and I walk out.
Okay. Well, one more thing. It's still easy to see your work on television, because a lot of your Western TV shows are being rerun. Western movies are sometimes on TV. Your movies with Burt Reynolds. So when you turn on the TV and one of your films or TV shows is on, and there you are risking your life doing a stunt, what goes through your mind?
I got a residual coming. Boy, the more they show them, the better I like them. Matter of fact, Smokey and the Bandit, you can't, I don't know where you live and things, but in California, in L.A., you can't go through the TV guide 1 week without seeing that thing on. I mean, it runs all the time, and every time I do, I go, oh, honey, we got another check coming, you know? So it's kind of nice. And all of that, being a little braggadocious, but I also own a percentage of the profits, so that don't hurt either.
Well, Hal Needham, it has really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thanks for all those great stunts you've done over the years.
Hey, listen, I appreciate it, lady, very much, and thanks for having me on.
Hal Needham's new memoir is called Stuntman. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. This is Fresh Air. With his innovative TV cop series, The Shield, starring Michael Chiklis as a rogue cop, series creator Sean Ryan put the FX network on the map. Tonight he unveils a new police drama, but this time the central characters are honest. And this time the series isn't made for cable. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
If you watched the Super Bowl yesterday, you saw plenty of promos for the new cop show from Fox. It's called The Chicago Code, and it's kind of the flip side of The Shield. It may turn out to be just as compelling. In The Shield, Vic Mackey and company were corrupt cops who would kill even their fellow officers to protect their power base and their often ill-gotten gains. Yet over the years, we rooted for Vic, rather than for the various police captains and lieutenants who tried to expose and fire him. He was like Tony Soprano with a badge. It was easy to like the guy, so long as you didn't look too closely. The Chicago Code, premiering tonight, flips that equation. In this show, the big corrupt figure is Alderman Ronan Gibbons, played by a smooth-looking Delroy Lindo from Get Shorty. He's got the makings of a classic TV villain and plays each scene with an almost snake-like smugness, like a black Chicago version of J.R. Ewing. Gibbons is a Chicago power broker with his hand in everything, legal or illegal. He recently appointed the city's first female police superintendent, Teresa Colvin, played by Jennifer Beals from Showtime's The L Word. He expects her to be subservient, naive, and easily controlled. It's the same logic that got Jimmy Stewart appointed as a junior senator in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and Teresa's appointment backfires just as quickly. She, too, is incorruptible and annoyingly persistent, and she decides to target Gibbons with a secret investigation. She enlists as her major confidant her former partner when she was a cop on the beat, Jarek Wysocki, played by another Showtime cable star, Jason Clark from Brotherhood. At first, he's reluctant to come aboard, until she reveals her whole card.
You know what, I like to fight the good fight as much as the next guy, but I'm not ready to start walking in there and start throwing haymakers at a heavyweight like Gibbons.
What if I told you that Gibbons was working with the Irish mob?
I've heard the rumors, I'm yet to see any of the proof.
Well, how's this for ammo? I've got a cop working undercover in their organization.
Undercover? How long?
Almost a year. He's working his way up the ladder, and pretty soon he's going to give us the connection to Gibbons. What would you say to that?
The fight just got fairer.
That's right.
There's one other key character in the Chicago Code, at least in its first three episodes. That's Caleb Evers, Jarek's brand new squad car partner. He's young, he's smart, and he's played by Matt Loria, who plays Luke Cafferty on Friday Night Lights. All three of these good guy cops come from excellent TV shows and turn in very strong performances. Matt Loria is understated but confident and lets you see the intelligence behind his character's silences. Jennifer Beals is strong enough to stand firm while dismissing a veteran cop who's furious at her, yet playful enough at other times to flash a quick smile or a quicker insult. And Jason Clark, as the moral center of the Chicago Code, is instantly likable. Well, not instantly. The entire pre-credit sequence of tonight's pilot, the all-important first impression, is so over the top, it plays like an expensive parody of a TV cop show rather than a real one. But ignore that. Let the dust settle and relax, because from that point on, the Chicago Code quickly finds its way. That way borrows a little from The Wire, HBO's landmark series about entrenched corrupt city institutions, and a little from Easy Streets, the vintage Paul Haggis cop series that gave equal weight to its good guys and its bad guys. But hey, those are great places to start. And what Sean Ryan is doing here that is quite original, and maybe almost revolutionary, is that he's swimming against the current of 21st century television. These days, almost all the smart and best shows are on cable, and the best TV talent has defected from broadcast to cable TV. Sean Ryan, who helped lead that revolution, is now reversing field. There aren't many intelligent shows left on broadcast television, but there are a few. The Good Wife, 30 Rock, Modern Family. And maybe, just maybe, like a few honest cops in a corrupt system, their presence and their efforts still can make a difference.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by the cabaret singer Mary Claire Herron. She died Saturday, 2 days after being hit by a car. She was 58. This is from her 1994 recording of classic songs from movies of the 1940s.
Maybe it happens this way. Maybe we really belong together. But after all, how little we know. Maybe it's just for a day. Love is as changeable as the weather. And after all, how little we know. Who knows why stars in the trees hide when it rains. Love comes along, casting a spell.